Now it's time to talk about William Randolph Hearst, the man the left loved to hate. He's the subject of a new biography titled The Chief. The author, David Nassau, is chair of the doctoral history program at the City University of New York, and he joins us now. David?
Thank you, John. Delighted to be here.
In the 40s and 50s, the Hearst Press was anathema to progressives. It was the Hearst Press that fueled the most virulent anti-communism, that led the attack on the New Deal. Few Americans have been so feared or so hated as William Randolph Hearst. In those years, the 40s and 50s, was Hearst as bad as his critics on the left said he was?
I think you can go back to the 30s if you want to talk about the hated Hearst. Yes, Hearst was violent, virulent, over the top. And the story that I tell in The Chief is not only about Hearst's attacks on the left, everyone from Roosevelt to Earl Browder, but the way in which he destroyed himself by doing it.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, mostly we know about Hearst through the 1941 Orson Welles film Citizen Kane, that occupies a chapter of your book, often described as America's greatest movie. Welles portrayed Hearst as a young man, as an energetic and attractive and ambitious person, actually not that different from Orson Welles himself, but as someone who, as he got older, became more right-wing, more oppressive, more unhappy. Do you disagree with that basic picture?
I disagree with just about everything in the Orson Welles movie, though I agree that it's an absolutely a great, great, great film. As biography and as history, it's terrible. As Orson Welles himself later admitted, that he had been wrong to characterize not only Hearst, but all the women in Hearst's life the way he did. The movie works as a film biography because Orson Welles is a megalomaniac. Orson Welles has huge appetites, ambitions, and self-confidence. And he was able to portray a man like William Randolph Hearst, who had huge, oversized ambitions, appetites, and self-confidence. But that's about as far as it goes. Hearst was, it's true, a leftist, a radical. He was to the left of the Socialist Party. He stole the thunder from the Socialist Party when he moved to New York.
And what years are we talking about?
We're talking about Hearst enters politics in around 1900. He decides he's going to be the next president of the United States. And he comes close. In 1904, he comes in second in the race for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. In 1905, he gets more votes for the mayor of New York City, but has the election stolen from him by Tammany, as his opponents all agreed. In 1906, he runs for governor, and Teddy Roosevelt, who's the president at the time, is so concerned that Hearst is going to be able to, once he's elected governor, unite the populist vote, Bryan's populist vote from the West and the South, with the urban progressive and the labor union vote in the North, that he will inaugurate a decades of Democratic rule. Roosevelt sets out to get him and in effect does so.
So the most striking thing to me about your book is this picture of the young Hearst as a progressive, a radical, not only in his own political engagements, but in his newspapers. His newspapers, you say, especially in New York and San Francisco, were pro-labor, pro-immigrant, attack the wealthy for their corruption and their crimes. You say FDR might never have been nominated as a Democratic candidate for president without the support of William Randolph Hearst. Why is that?
Well, Hearst disliked Hoover immensely. He had supported Hoover.
We're talking about Herbert here, not J. Edgar.
Right, right, right. Another Hoover. Right. When Hoover sent out the army to roust the bonus marchers, Hearst was livid, and he swore that he would get Hoover out of there. And he did not initially support Roosevelt. He thought he was too much of an internationalist. But when it became clear that Hearst candidate John Nance Garner was not going to get the nomination for the presidency, Hearst moved his support from Garner to Roosevelt, got Roosevelt over the top when it looked like there might be a deadlocked convention, and then used all his power and his 20 million daily readers. 20 million daily readers, when the population was half what it is today, he used all his power to get Roosevelt elected.
So here we have a publisher and a political activist who's got a record now a couple decades old, pro-labor, pro-immigrant, ruthless critique of the wealthy, who then in this period of the mid-30s switches from the left to the right. And to me, this is the most fascinating and the most puzzling thing about his life. Why does he move from left to right and in this relatively short period?
He moves from left to right for the simplest of all reasons. He can no longer afford to be a leftist. In his early years, he owned newspapers. He was a wealthy man. But he did not have San Simeon. He did not have an estate in Northern California. He didn't have a beach house for his lover, Marion Davies. He didn't have an estate in Sands Point for his wife. He didn't have a castle in Wales. He wasn't one of the wealthiest men in the world. He could afford to be a leftist. And he could afford to be a leftist because he was out to regulate, to reform capitalism, to stop the abuses of the trusts, of monopoly. By the 1930s, he believed that those abuses had been taken care of by the progressive era. He believed that those abuses, in large part because of his action as a politician and as a journalist activist, had been taken care of, that capitalism was regulated, that there needed no controls over capitalism. When the New Deal came along, and especially the Second New Deal, when Roosevelt moves to the left in 1934 and begins talking about wage and price controls in every realm of industry, including the newspaper industry, Hearst will have none of it. When Hearst was going to lead the revolution to tame and reform capitalism, he was in favor of that revolution. When Roosevelt and the leftists, or as Hearst referred to them, the leftists surrounding Roosevelt were going to lead that revolution, he wanted nothing to do with it. And then, to make things worse, Roosevelt institutes an income tax.
You know, I noticed that in your book that the income tax seemed to loom, something as simple as Hearst's own self-interest in not being taxed, the classic Republican issue of the Reagan era, seems to loom large in his political transformation.
It's huge. The Republicans had virtually eliminated the income tax when Harding is elected and when Andrew Mellon is the Secretary of the Treasury. And from 1920 to 1935, Hearst and other millionaires paid precious little income tax. In 1935, Roosevelt told Hearst through an intermediary that he had no choice. The only way he was going to save democracy from the Coghlans on the right and the Browders on the left was to eliminate some of the inequalities, and he was going to go after the millionaires. He said if a couple of millionaires have to be sacrificed to save the republic, to save capitalism, to save democracy, I'm going to do it. Well, Hearst was one of those millionaires, and he did not take kindly to this new policy.
We're talking with David Nassau, the author of a new book, The Chief, a biography of William Randolph Hearst. David, can we talk about Hitler?
Of course we can talk about Hitler.
You report in your book, I was amazed to learn that William Randolph Hearst had Hitler on his payroll. This doesn't look too good.
No, but he also had Mussolini, which look good. But he had Churchill. He had David Lloyd George. He had Eleanor Roosevelt. I can go on and on and on and on.
So he had everybody working
for him. Everybody was working for him. Everybody wrote a column for him. As long as they were careful, including Eleanor Roosevelt, not to touch on subjects that Hearst, not to go against Hearst, on the subjects that he held strong opinions on.
So Hitler was a columnist for the Hearst Press?
Hitler and Mussolini were columnists. Now, Hitler didn't last terribly long because when he was a party leader, he was willing to accept less money than Mussolini. But when he became head of state, he demanded equity with Mussolini.
Hearst seems only fair.
Well, Hearst, it wasn't fair, according to Hearst, because Hitler was not nearly as good a journalist. He was late with his copy. It needed to be rewritten. And he promised to give Hearst exclusives and then dared to give his opinions to the German newspapers before he gave them to Hearst.
These columnists, you can't trust
right.
them.
So Hearst fired him and replaced him with Goering.
So did you read these columns that Adolf Hitler wrote for the Hearst Press?
Yes.
What were they like?
Well, you can imagine what they were like. That Hitler, they also appeared with these photographs of Hitler in leather jackets, arms akimbo, looking as strong and forceful as he possibly could, and talking about the rebirth of Germany, that he was going to rescue Germany, and he was going to destroy the Versailles Treaty, which is exactly what Hearst wanted.
And so Hearst kind of welcomed Hitler's initiatives on this front?
Hearst believed that a strong Germany was necessary to the peace of Europe. Hearst believed that if France and England got too strong, or if Russia got too strong, there would be problems, and that we needed a balance of power in Europe, and that Hitler was going to bring that balance of power by remilitarizing Germany and by making it stronger. Hearst was by this time so convinced of his own power, especially over his employees like Hitler, that he believed that he could talk Hitler. He could become Hitler's advisor, and he could talk Hitler out of his anti-Semitism. And in July of 1934, the two of them had a private meeting, and Hearst said to Hitler,
Adolf.
He says, this stuff has to stop. You can be a great world leader, but not until you treat the German Jews as citizens with the same rights as all other Germans.
I gather he didn't succeed.
Well, he thought he had.
Really?
He thought he had. And for until 1938, he believed, Hearst believed, that Hitler was going to change the policies towards the Jews. And Hearst convinced himself, as a lifetime of power will do to one, Hearst convinced himself that Hitler would in the end do as Hearst had told him to do.
We're speaking with David Nassau about his new biography of William Randolph Hearst. It's titled The Chief. David, Hearst is best known as a newspaper publisher, but you show that he was really the first to create the kind of media conglomerates that dominate our world today. How close did he come to doing what Time Warner and AOL have done here?
Well, a long, long time ago, before the word synergy was in use, Hearst created the concept. He produced, he learned very early that film, theaters, movies needed newspapers, that without the newspapers to promote them and their stars, there would be no film industry. So he decided, why not go into film? He produced The Perils of Pauline, the first serials. He was one of the pioneers in newsreels. He produced his own feature films. He produced and bought his own radio network. He was the largest publisher of magazines as well as newspapers in the world. And he spread his content over all of those media.
So how did this work? Like if you wrote an article for a Hearst magazine?
In 1916, he told the editors of Cosmopolitan that from that moment on, this is 1916, that they were only to buy short stories and only to buy fiction that could be made into movies.
Wow.
And he demanded that every author who published in Cosmopolitan sign over their movie options to the Hearst publications. In 1915, the year before that, he began to do animated films of all the comic characters, the Katzenjammer Kids and Mutt and Jeff, because he, not the artist, owned the rights to those characters, and he made them into animated cartoons that he sold with his newsreels.
So he had this synergy going, his newspapers, his magazines, his newsreels, his Hollywood studios. And then he ran into problems. And then it all fell apart. What did he do wrong?
It all fell apart, I think, because he put his politics and his politics, which became increasingly distasteful to his working class constituents, he put those politics out front instead of hiding behind editorial writers or publishing his ideas only on the editorial page. He loudly proclaimed where he stood in signed editorials that he put on the front page of his newspapers.
We've got 3 or 4 minutes left here. I wanted to talk about biography in general here. Biographers have a problem. They have strong feelings about their subjects, and this can go in two directions. You can have biographers who love their subjects too much, defend them against all comers. They can't do anything wrong. Here I think of our friend Blanche Wiesen Cook writing about Eleanor Roosevelt, or else they do the opposite. Robert Caro on LBJ. It's an indictment. It's, every bad thing their subject ever did. I must say you did a wonderful job of avoiding the pitfalls, but I wonder where you end up as a biographer on Hearst. Do you love him or do you hate him?
I love him and hate him. I was very, very, very fortunate, and Hearst gave me what every biographer dreams of. He gave me a subject that was never boring. Whether I loved him, whether I hated him, I was never bored by him, and he always surprised me. I tried very hard to be fair to him when I wanted to applaud his trust-busting, when I wanted to scream and condemn his vicious anti-communism, his destruction of the careers of innocent school teachers and professors who he claimed were communist. But I tried not to cheer or to condemn, but to tell the story.
Well, David, you did a wonderful job, and I want to thank you for coming into KPFK today.
My pleasure. Thank you.